Brother Covington, anybody can listen to you and tell you from somewhere in the Southwest, but exactly where and when did you come on the scene?
Well, I was born on January the 19th, 1911 in Texas, East Texas, and on a farm. And then I was raised on the farm, and that's at a place east of Dallas. And I worked my way through school after that. And then my father was on the Texas Ranger Force, and he was transferred to San Antonio, Texas, and that's where I went into law school. And
well, how did you happen to come in the truth then?
Well, I came to a knowledge of the truth because my father was transferred from San Antonio, Texas, down to the valley as a Texas Ranger, and at that transfer I had to have a place to stay, and I stayed with two friends of mine that I went to school with. They had a room for me. I was friendly with them, and so they asked me to move in with them, and I did. And as I got there, the father, the head of the family, was an old man who was in bad health, and he had all the boys come in on a Sunday and listen to him talk about world conditions. And then he interested me, and I got very interested in what he has to say because I was myself fed up with the way things were going, and like all young kids are, they're dissatisfied, you know, with the establishment, and I was very much so at that time. And I was just flirting with controversial ideas, and he was full of controversy against the system of things, and what he preached appealed to me very much, and so I listened to him, and he asked us to come in, and then he would turn on the radio station, KTSA, that had the recorded broadcasts of J.F. Judge Rutherford, as he was called and known. And so he insisted on our listening, and I listened, and I was highly pleased with what I heard.
Was the fact that Brother Rutherford was a lawyer, did that impress you too? Did that make it more interesting to you?
Well, it, well, I knew that, well, I mean, he presented the thing in a way that was uncontrovertible by me. As a lawyer, I could see that he really knew what he was talking about 100%, and that he very much was very persuasive, and I was a ready, willing listener, and a willing, well, I was willing to join up with him in his opposition to the...
You were right for the truth.
I was right for her.
Was this still in East Texas? Or
no, this was in San Antonio.
Oh, in San Antonio.
Yeah, we had moved, my father had moved from East Texas down to San Antonio.
And when did you first meet Brother Rutherford in the flesh?
Well, that was in Houston in 1900, and I forget the year. It was back in way before I came to Bethel. I went over to Houston to with a group of brothers that knew that they were having a special meeting over there, and Brother Rutherford was there because Brother Isaac lived down in Houston at that time. He's dead now, Joe Isaac. He was a great friend of the judge.
Mm-hmm. And heard his name while I was in Texas. Mm-hmm. Tell me this, when you took the truth and you began to go to meetings, how did your daddy react to that? Because he was
home. He got to be very hostile against what I was doing when I went to the witness meetings, and because he had great ambitions for me to be a politician, you see. Mm-hmm. And I was actually working in the county courthouse in the county clerk's office, and I had a political job, but I wasn't out whenever they were campaigning. I was out preaching, mm-hmm. you see. And so I had a political job, but in a political office, but I didn't go on with it.
When were you actually admitted to the bar?
Well, I was admitted to the bar in the year of 1933.
Ah, so then you practiced law for a little while before you went to Bethel.
Bethel, oh yes, sure. I was an active practitioner at the bar in San Antonio. After I took the bar examination, and incidentally, I took the bar examination a year before I got out of school and passed it.
Well,
and then you still had to go the extra year.
In order to get my certificate of graduation, which I did, you see.
Did you set up your own firm or join a law firm there?
Well, I was working for a big law firm there that when I got admitted to the bar, and I passed it with such high grades, the head of the law firm, Morrison and Bergstrom came and offered me a job.
Well, how did you get involved then in defending the witnesses working for the brothers?
Well, that came about after I quit the Morrison firm and went over with R.H. Mercer, who was a defender of damage suits for the Maryland Casualty Company in San Antonio. And there were some brothers that got arrested down in the valley because of a meeting that was held down there. And I went down and appeared in their behalf and got the case thrown out. And then it was that my name reached the society, and then they assigned me to represent the society in a will contest case up in Kerrville, Texas, and handled that for the society. And then the brothers got involved in controversy with the San Antonio police, and that's when we get into the matter of Brother Heath.
You know. Right. So that, when you met
the information marches, they had cops were trying to stop them, and it became necessary for me to have a conference with the mayor of the city of San Antonio on whether we had the right, whether Jehovah's Witnesses had the right to engage in the information marches, carrying the sign, "Religion is a snare and a racket."
That made a lot of people mad, didn't it? But you won that then. And
well, we, I, by pleading with the mayor, he saw that we had the right to, I mean, I made him, I didn't make him, I mean, the Lord made him, but I was the one that offered the proposition. But the thing is that Brother Heath was in San Antonio on the occasion of that visit.
See, now, Brother Heath, if I remember correctly, he worked in Brother Rutherford's office.
He was secretary to Brother Rutherford.
Right, that's right.
Mm-hmm.
And
then he saw you there and invited you to Bethel?
Well, he invited me not to Bethel. He invited me to attend the Madison Square Garden Convention.
Is that the one where they had all of was that the one where they had the riot?
Well, that's where the Catholic Action tried to break the meeting up, you see.
What year was that again?
That was 1939.
Mm-hmm. See, that's the record. Part of that riot is on the old record.
It's on the Government and Peace, you see. Mm-hmm. That's the record, Government and Peace, and you can hear the mob action in the from upstairs there.
Yeah.
And then when the mob started, well, then Brother Heath got down off of the speaker's platform because he was in charge of all the ushers, you see.
Mm-hmm.
And he headed up there, and when he headed, I headed too.
Mm-hmm.
And when he went up the stairway, and that meandering stairway up into the Madison Square Garden, the old Madison Square Garden, not the one that's there today, they've got a different one now. Why, I followed him, and we went together, and they were screaming and mad, and just the same sort of noise that you hear on that Government and Peace record was yelled into our ears as we were going up there to maintain law and order in that religious gathering, huh?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And the cops were on the outside and hands off, you see, and allowing those Calvinites to go ahead and do what they did, which was to break up the meeting, or try to break it up.
Mm-hmm.
And we went up there, and we had canes, you know, to maintain order, and we tried to push the mobsters out of the way, and when we did, why, one mobster grabbed Brother Heath and hurt him very badly, physically. And that's also written up in the society publications. You know, it's in there where they grabbed him by the private parts as he was going up the stairway. And he hit one of these mobsters over the head with a cane in order to break up the crowd that was coming around us. And when he did that, well, then, of course, the cops moved in from the outside and was in conspiracy working with the mobsters. And they put Brother Heath under arrest because of his having hit the mobster with the cane.
Mm-hmm.
And he was in the right, Brother Heath was, but the cops didn't think so, and they went ahead and did their part of helping the mobsters, and they took Brother Heath into custody, and then I became the chief witness for the defense, meaning Brother Heath. And, mm-hmm. and when the case went to the courts after that, why, I was called up from San Antonio, Texas to testify. I made two or three trips up on the train, 2 or 3 days trip. And anyhow, in the end, Brother Heath was tried by three judges that were black-robed representatives of the state of New York to enforce the felony law. And they were going to try to get him, but as the judges ruled, based on the testimony that I gave supporting Brother Heath's self-defense, that he was not guilty. They held that the testimony that was given by a member of the bar, whom we believe is more credible than the mobsters that had testified against him, you see,
who
came in to break him. So Brother Heath was acquitted as a result of Jehovah's provision and having me there to give testimony.
I remember on that record, Brother Rutherford saying, you know, saying that they will not break up this meeting, and he just went on talking, and you could
He says, by God's grace, the Nazis and the fascists will not break this meeting up. And that is the way that it was not broken up, was because the brother maintained law and order.
They used those canes. You know, at that time, there was already some litigation going on. For example, I think the Lovell case was...
Well, the Lovell case had gone on up, and the judge had authorized the appeal of that, and Mr. Moyle, who was at that time at Bethel, handled that case. I had nothing to do with that case. I didn't come into any of the Society's Supreme Court cases until after the... Well, after when the Snyder case was argued, Brother Rutherford argued the Snyder case, Snyder against Irvington, New Jersey, and he and I, Brother Rutherford and I, were together in that case. And
what was that case? Was that,
that
a flag sweep?
No, it wasn't. That was not a flag sweep. That was an ordinance, literature distribution case. Now, the flag case was a different case, and that came on for hearing in 1940, and that was adverse to us, of
first
course.
One, right?
Yeah, the first one. And then later on, of course, they reversed themselves as a result of our taking that up. Still, that's another chapter that we can get into. But coming back, if you'd like, so that we can maintain continuity.
So, let's see, I was at the point where you went to that Madison Square Garden.
That's the one.
Right.
That's the one where the mobsters tried to break the meeting.
Right. That was in 1939.
That was 1939. Yeah.
So it must have been shortly after that that you were invited to Bethel.
On account of the fact that I had made a firm defense for Brother Heath, and the lawyer for the society pulled out, and he didn't believe in the self-defense, you see. And he quit, and Brother Rutherford was in need of somebody, so then he called on me, but I was not aware of what was going on. time, but when it did happen, well, then he invited me to come, and I came.
Now, that's very interesting. Now, as we think of, you were in one field of law, but you almost got into constitutional law.
Yeah, I was in the casualty insurance defense, you know, personal injury and representing insurance companies and that sort of thing, in damage suit cases and then bond forfeiture cases and bond obligation cases. And then, of course, when I went to Bethel, I was in a different area altogether, contrastingly so, but still, I had enough trial experience and appellate argument, court experience, that it was easy for me to just shift into the position of defending Jehovah's Witnesses. And it was good because I was able to do what I liked, which was to defend my client, and then also, when you've got a righteous cause, it gives you a double barrel.
That's right, what you really believed in. That was good.
Can I ask you something? So then you went to Bethel about 1939?
1939, Brother Rutherford called me in, but that was after the Madison Square Garden riot case, and it was because of the fact that other lawyer by the name of Moyle had quit and left Brother Rutherford holding the bag, and I got an invitation to come by special delivery from Brother Rutherford, and I went immediately. I didn't make any, you know, delays or anything. I had to transfer cases to a dozen or two lawyers in order to make that change, you see.
You and Brother Rutherford we're on a couple of cases together, you mentioned.
Right.
And I always think of you as a lawyer and him as a writer, but was he a pretty good lawyer also?
Yes, he was. He was very, very good. He was an eloquent speaker, and he maintained dignity and got the very high respect of the members of the bar that listened to him. I mean, members of the court that listened to him argue in the Gobitis case, and then in the Gobitis case.
Right. So let's see, you got started in 40. What were some of the first major cases you were involved in? I know a little bit about some of the cases, but what were some of the first ones? The flag salute case came along in 40.
Well, the flag salute case, the first flag salute, I was with Brother Rutherford, but I had nothing to do in the argument of that case. Brother Rutherford argued that. But he did a good job. The reason it was lost was not because of Brother Rutherford, but because of the times that we're in, you know.
Yeah.
War was on, and the flag issue was, the heat was on us from every angle. Mm-hmm. And
then I guess it began for a little while there to just get, just piled up, law cases just
really. Oh my, yeah, they were coming at us so fast and furious, you see, that it was an 18-hour-a-day job for me to cope with it, but I was young and dedicated and devouring of any opposition that we had. I kept on keeping on all the time, you see.
You've got some
happy to do it.
Some of these things here, and I'm not too familiar with, you can tell me about some of them. For example, I know about the Harlan, Kentucky case, and I've got a question or two about that, but
yeah.
This Connersville, Indiana, what kind of situation was that?
Well, that was a mob situation that occurred while we were trying that seditious conspiracy case in Connersville. And Connersville was a hotbed of American Legion action, and they ruled the whole town with domineering. And the Connersville case occurred. I used Brother Franz as my witness in that case. And the jury was out, and it was necessary for me to close the case off, not to close the case down, but to get out of the case. And I finished the argument of the case and at Connersville, and I tried to get a postponement of the case in Maine, and they wouldn't put it off. And as a result of that, I had to race from Indianapolis to Cincinnati to catch the plane to Boston, and that is the thing that saved my life, because that night they had conspired to kill me. And as they see, I went to catch the airplane in Cincinnati out of Connersville, and then Brother Victor Schmidt, who was with me as co-counsel, he is now dead, he stayed, and he and his wife, Sister Schmidt, were mobbed by the crowd that was, and as they mobbed them that night in the darkness after the case was over, why, they were screaming and yelling that they were going to kill me that night. Well, it was just that the Lord delivered me at the right time. I would have been killed that night myself, because I wanted to stay there for the verdict, you see.
How was the verdict?
Well, the verdict was adverse, and I took an appeal. I had to go back into town to take the appeal afterwards, and the same group of conspirators were there, and I got in and out in a hurry in time to take the appeal, and then we made the appeal effective and got the case reversed on appeal. But that was after, you know, a tremendous effort was put forth, and a lot of blood, sweat, and tears was involved, and it was a part of the conspiracy to wipe us out in Connersville, but by Jehovah's undeserved kindness, they didn't. And a good testimony was given. Those two sisters were convicted of conspiracy and given jail terms, and we got them out of bail. I got them out of bail, on bail, and we appealed the case to the Supreme Court of Indiana, and it was reversed. And they were acquitted by the court, the Supreme Court of Indiana, on appeal. And the decision came down on Pearl Harbor Day.
Is that right?
Yeah.
I noticed you've got a note here, too, about Oscar Pillars. Now, he's the brother that was in Texas.
In Texas, and East Texas. He was up there in East Texas, and they show you the intense prejudice in that area, you see. They literally mobbed him and hung him up on a telephone pole, and the rope was cut by the steel bars on the telephone pole, the angle bars. And that was the thing that saved his life.
Yeah,
That later went to court, I think.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And the persons who were guilty of trying to hang him, trying to kill him, I think they fled the state.
Yeah.
Now, of course, it's Harlan County, Kentucky. Sister Murray and I served over there near Harlan County, and we heard some interesting stories about Harlan, Kentucky.
And then Somerset, too. Somerset and Harlan were both involved.
Now, that one, what was their objection to the witnesses?
Well,
in Harlan?
It was same as here. That was where the prosecutor said that if he got me back down into Harlan, he was going to boil me in oil. They had a conspiracy charge against the brothers, seditious conspiracy charge, and I then filed an injunction against them in the federal court, filed an injunction suit against the prosecution of that case in federal court at Lexington, and or rather in London federal court, and I got an injunction against the state of Kentucky. And it's standing to this day, knocking that sedition law out as unconstitutional, and the prosecution out as unconstitutional. And the federal judges that heard the case gave us a vindication of the matter. And it was a highly controversial and hotly contested case. And the thing that was interesting was that the prosecutor said, well, he was basing his charge on the grounds that this literature was conspiratorial and seditious, and
the chief judge of the federal court, he says, well now, Mr. District Attorney, it's now 11 o'clock. Court will adjourn, and you be back tomorrow with the proof. So, court was adjourned, and he came back the next day. Of course, he had no proof that there was anything, although he had all those books, and that's when he was making that statement to the other guys in the room. If he gets that guy cutting him back down into Harlan, he was going to boil me in oil. You see,
I understand that some of the brothers were next to them, yeah, in the room that night.
Yeah, they were, because we had taken up all the hotel
rooms. Didn't like that to it later.
And all those officers of the law had to bunk up.
That's where they, let's see, is that where, let's see, they spent that night, the whole night, looking, researching the literature.
Yeah, yeah. And they had the lights on, and the sheriff and the marshal says to old Daniel Boone Smith, he says, Daniel, turn out the light. He says, we need some sleep. That was funny.
Oh, man. Yeah, it was real funny now to tell about it, but
yeah,
it was pretty tough.
Well, it
at that
was
time,
tough then. Our life was at stake, you
yeah,
know, and we were
right.
fighting with her back to the wall, but Jehovah gave us vindication, but it was a tough time.
You're not kidding. You know, let's see, a couple of cases you don't have down here, but that I know about personally. For example, you had, did you fight the case of Jones versus Opelika?
Yes, that was a case that was taken up to the Supreme Court involving the validity of the license tax law, and that came up from Alabama. And we lost it first, and then that it was a companion case of Jones against Opelika and Jobin against Arkansas and Jobin against Arizona and another person against the state of Arkansas. Right. And those three cases were put together and the Supreme Court heard them and they decided them adversely to us first, and then on rehearing, they set aside their opinion, but that didn't come automatically. We had to argue with our back to the wall in that, and that's when Justice Murphy filed his dissenting opinion in the case, and he complained about the Jehovah's Witnesses having been persecuted by mob violence and all other sorts of conspiracies that the public officials had used to stop their work. That's when Murphy gave that dissenting opinion in favor of Jehovah's Witnesses. And then, of course, after that, why, the other cases were taken in from Pennsylvania, and that meant that the case would have to be reopened because it was a very serious question that the court had grabbed a hold of, and it was good too that they brought the other cases in, otherwise the case would have to stand and would not be reheard, you see.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was wondering about, now, as I understand it, on the license tax cases, a little municipality would say, well, we've got to sell your literature or to work here in our town,
you've
got
to come in and have a license and pay a tax, too.
Yeah, but when you went to get a license, they didn't sell you license.
No,
you didn't qualify for it.
You didn't qualify, yeah.
So that way,
that way we got prosecuted and on account of not having the license. But the thing is that we believe that the license was ungodly anyhow.
Right.
We never would have gotten it.
Yeah.
And that's why we were defending the case, is because they were making an imposition upon our constitutional rights and contrary to our conscience.
Mm-hmm. Now, let's see, Murphy...
Justice Murphy filed a dissent in that case.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, he's got a good name, Murphy.
Oh, yeah,
you know,
he was... he made a good name for himself.
Later on, yes.
Yeah, well, because he was always dissenting in our favor. And they wrote an article in the law review, some guys did, to the effect that if Justice Murphy is ever sainted, it'll be by the Jehovah's Witnesses, not by the Catholic Church. He was a notorious Catholic. You know?
That it's odd that he would be so strong for justice, you know, when he had that background. And
but he was very much in favor of what we were doing, and he knew that the life of the country depended on the success.
But not all the justices were that way. For example, Felix Frankfurter.
Oh, he was very adverse. Goodness, he was so hostile. And yet he was a Jew, too. And he was against us in the flag case and against us in the license tax cases. And
I read some of the opinions, and it's amazing that he, coming from a persecuted minority, the Jewish minority, was so tough on the witnesses.
Oh boy, he said it. He was really vicious too, and he tried to justify himself, but he was a hypocrite, really, in my feeling about the matter. And he was an enemy. He was Rab Shaki. Rab Shekhar.
Let me go back to this other point here. Now, in the flag salute case, the first one, we got an adverse opinion in 1940. Then on Flag Day, I guess in 43, it was reversed.
The reason it was reversed was because I brought an injunction case in the United States District Court in the District of West Virginia to restrain the enforcement of the state flag salute regulation that required compulsory saluting of the flag by children in the schools. And I challenged that as unconstitutional, and that gave the opportunity then to force the court into a position of deciding the matter again. And the thing was that I brought an injunction suit against the enforcement of the regulation, and it gave me the right then to impanel what they call a three-judge statutory court. And then that gave us automatically the right of an appeal directly to the Supreme Court of the United States.
Yep. Now, I don't really understand that part, because I always...
Well, it's a highly technical thing, but still, it gave a speedy, quick decision that we other not... Other, and we needed a speedy, quick decision. And when we were arguing that case in the district court, Judge John J. Parker, who was from... over in North Carolina, was sitting, presiding on the court, and the Attorney General for West Virginia got up and said, well, it's not necessary for me to argue this case, he says. The Supreme Court of the United States has already decided this case against the Jehovah's Witnesses and Mr. Covington, who was in the case. And as a consequence of that, Judge Parker says, Mr. Attorney General, if you are relying on the Gobitis case, you'd better argue this case. He said it wasn't necessary for him to argue. So he said, you'd better argue this case. This is what Judge Parker said. So then he was flabbergasted. And the Attorney General, he was taken off of his feet, and he didn't know what to say.
That's the thing that puzzled me. I thought that once the Supreme Court had decided on something, that that was the decision. But
well, the Supreme Court of the United States can always reverse themselves and reopen the thing, and that's the very thing I had in mind when I filed that case down there, was to challenge that and get them to reopen it. And the only way I could do it quickly is to get a three-judge court, you see, and then bingo, I'd shoot right into the Supreme Court of the United States and bypass the intermediary appellate court, and that way we would have them on the run.
Now, that's interesting. There must have been somebody, though, or there must have been some indication that the Supreme Court would have been willing to hear it again. Or did you just think that...
Well, I knew that I didn't have any inside information because you never get any commitment out of the courts, you know, or anything like that. I knew that when Roy Gamble, who was one of Jehovah's Witnesses, was painting the picture of Justice Murphy in Lansing, Michigan, as an artist there, they dedicated a picture to hang in the Capitol in Lansing. Why he had made the statement, Justice Murphy had made a statement to Roy Gamble, who complained about the adversity that Jehovah's Witnesses had been put in, that Frank Murphy said to him, said, well, I know that, but he says, someday we're going to do something about that.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And then it's when, yeah.
Yeah. Now, let's see. I want to ask something about these sedition laws, too, because some of my friends were involved in those sedition laws, particularly that one down in Mississippi.
Yeah. Well, that Mississippi case was a thing that we took up to the Supreme Court of the United States along with the flag, the second flag case. You know, the West Virginia State Board of Education against Barnett. And I took the appeal in the Mississippi case. Well, it was a sedition based on the refusal to, explaining the reason for your refusal to salute the flag in literature that had been distributed, and that's what the brothers were doing, putting literature out explaining why Jehovah's Witnesses did not salute the flag. And they were accused then of violating the seditious conspiracy law of Mississippi on that account.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the case that we brought up along with the rehearing in the flag case, in the West Virginia case, you see. Flag.
And they all reached the court at the same time, didn't they?
They all dovetailed in there together, and only Jehovah could.
I think the paper said there was a field day for Jehovah's Witnesses.
Yeah, well, that's what Judge Waite said, it was a field day for Jehovah's Witnesses when they handed down those decisions, and that was in on Flag Day in 1943. And Judge Waite, who wrote that article entitled, I think I made a note of it, entitled The Legal Indebtedness, or The Indebtedness, Constitutional Debt of the American People to Jehovah's Witnesses, was the title of it, and he had a big long article in there in the Minnesota Law Review that covered about 40 pages, and that's the title of it. And he goes on and makes a detailed account of the decisions that were handed down on that day, including that Jones against versus Opelika being reversed and the Mississippi case being handed down and reversed, you see, the Supreme Court of Mississippi and all that. That really was a field day for Jehovah's Witnesses.
It was a good time, because I think that's the...
It turned the tide.
That's right. That's the point. That's what you'd point to. Things got a little better from then on.
Well, the publicity then turned the other way. The newspapers had been very adverse in their publicity against Jehovah's Witnesses, you know, all over the country. And then when we gave them a licking, why then
they had to
their song was a different direction.
Yeah, it's as if Jehovah God swallowed up a flood.
Yeah, a flood.
Yeah. Of adversity against his people.
Yeah.
Well, see, there's a couple more cases that come to mind. The one that involved me, of course.
Yeah.
You never knew the one that involved me.
I didn't.
But those were the draft cases.
Oh, yeah, well, the draft cases. Yeah, well, sure, I was very much involved in the draft cases because I had to meet with all the military authority in Washington when they were considering the case of whether Jehovah's Witnesses would be allowed exemption from the draft under the law as ministers of religion, you see, and also whether they were entitled to the benefit of conscience objectors. and they had a big room full of brass, you see, officers of all the whole army. I mean, when I say the whole army, I mean the guys that had the administration of the draft.
Mm-hmm.
And among that group was General Lewis B. Hershey.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you get the opinion from some of the reading that he was more or less in favor of allowing this conscientious objection.
Yeah, well, he was in favor of giving us a good, even break, you know. I mean, he was a really an honorable man, a man of integrity. And I liked him very much. He's dead now, as a matter of fact. He died about 3 years ago, I think, mm-hmm. over in Indiana. He comes from Indiana. He is a... he was an expert on the draft, though. He was the best in the world on conscription.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why Roosevelt put him in charge of the draft administration. And he was a corny type of a man, but very brilliant, you know, sharp and quick. And able to defend himself very well before the Congress, and he did a very good job in a very fine way. And he was honorable and fair in his dealing with Jehovah's Witnesses. He wasn't, so he agreed on certain ones, and I said, well, all right, then if you agree on those, we'll have to fight over the rest, you know.
I guess they got real emotional and patriotic.
Oh, yes, sure, but still, they were cold-blooded, too, you know, those army men. That's just mm-hmm. a matter of just like cutting meat, you know.
Yeah, to them,
I mean, they're cold as cucumbers.
A man was just a piece of material.
Yeah, he's just a piece of war material.
And that's
stuff.
All he was. How many of our brothers finally wound up in prison during
the
war?
Well, we had 2,500 that went to jail during the war, but... we kept an awful lot of them out, and we had a tremendous number of cases that were taken up and appealed under the draft law, and there was a big day that we had a turning of the tide in the Supreme Court on the draft cases, too.
There were about four of those cases.
Yeah, the three or four of them right. were set together, and I argued them. And,
yeah, I remember that. That was in the early 50s, wasn't it?
Well, it was, you see... we lost the Falbo case. That was the first draft case, and they ruled against us on the grounds that we had not exhausted our remedies by taking an appeal, which was unnecessary in order to exhaust our remedies. An appeal was taken, but I mean inside the draft law, they held that we were supposed to take a second physical examination, you see. And it was not necessary because the first physical examination was enough to settle the guy's eligibility physically for the draft.
Mm-hmm.
And they took the position that it was necessary for him to go back to take the second one. And I argued that that was unnecessary and unreasonable and arbitrary and capricious to make such a demand upon us in order to get the benefit of the law. And Frankfurter was dead against us on the thing, and so was a large number of the other judges. But in the end, we won those draft cases on the second go-around, and we established the right to be heard on our defense as ministers in the prosecution. At first, they held that we didn't even have the right to make a defense. And then, because of this business of not having taken that second physical, which was an unnecessary thing in my opinion, as I said in the argument to the court, it was not necessary because it had been predetermined for his acceptability on the first physical, you see.
Yeah. See, that's the one I say that established when I came along, more to 1957, and by that time, why... I wasn't pioneering yet, but I just told them I was one of Jehovah's Witnesses, and they automatically gave me a conscientious objection.
Yeah.
No problem for me.
But we had a lot of difficulty in
establishing that, but in the end we prevailed. Jehovah gave us the victory in these cases. Yeah. Not all of us got the thing without its difficulty, but in the end we finally won in the draft cases, and we got the decision from the Supreme Court of the right to make a defense in the case of Lewis Dabney Smith, and who is a circuit servant down in this area.
Lewis Smith, I know
Lewis Dabney. Lewis Dabney Smith.
I think I dropped the Dabney part.
Yeah.
We know Lewis Smith.
Well, I'm real well. Yeah, Lewis' fine brother.
And William Murray Estep, he was the other one. He was Pittsburgh, and Smith was from South Carolina. And Smith had an interesting case because his old man caused him to be kidnapped, you see.
How's that?
Well, his old man got the cops and kidnapped him from home and took him down forcibly to the induction station, you see.
Hmm.
The old man knew that he wasn't going to show up. So he forcibly took him down there. And Lewis was there, and then I had to sue to get him out of the army.
He was in.
Oh, yeah. We went around and around in his case, and we also went around and around the others. That was a big battle, that draft thing.
Oh, my.
But we gave him a receipt for every blow. They were getting ready to indict me, you see. Yeah, they were, really.
They'll lock you away, boy.
Yeah.
They tell me this one. Did you
when
get
they it? Told me that, I said, do you know my address? Yeah, you know my address, so.
Know where to come to get you.
Yeah.
Tell me this, did you get involved in the Canadian problem?
Oh, yes, I did quite a lot. I would spend a lot of time up in Canada, and then there is that Quebec situation was very bad, and I worked very closely with Brother Howe. I used him in the cases up there because I couldn't plead any cases in Canada at all, and I used him, and I worked with him, and he was my alter ego, and we worked together, and we gave them a good run for their money in Canada, and actually we got very good results out of the Canadian Supreme Court. We got we went in the seditious conspiracy cases, that is seditious libel they called it, cases that was brought against Jehovah's Witnesses, and also in a large number of other cases, and we had the Supreme Court split in Canada on that account, and the court ruled in our favor, a split decision, but still they came around in our favor, and it was a good, a very good decision that they gave us in Canada, and Canada is based on the common law, you see, and we went in there under that freedom of worship statute in Quebec, too, and we made use of that as the first time in history that it was written for the Catholic Church. They never had to use it, but we used it successfully in the case involving Laurier Samour, who...
Right, I remember.
You know,
he ran the restaurant.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah. Well, no, that was the restaurant case. We used it in Laurier Samour case. That was a witnessing case.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, but the other case involved... the brother that run the restaurant, and that case was won too, you see.
Right, they tried to break him.
Yeah, they tried to break him because his signing bonds, you see, for the brothers. And Frank Roncarelli, that's who you're talking about in that case. He was the man that ran the restaurant, and he was a very fine brother. I mean, and he stood up for Jehovah's name in a very courageous way, and really... gave Du Plessis a run for his money, and we gave Du Plessis a run for his money too in the courts up there.
He said, I am the law.
Yeah.
That's the way he felt about it.
Yeah, you said it.
He was a mean guy, that Plessy was, and when we gave testimony, Brother Franz and I gave testimony up there in that Laurier Samoa case in the trial court, and then it went on up through the appellate courts, you see. And I was around when we argued the case, when the case was argued in the Supreme Court of Canada, too, but Glenn handled the argument very well and very capably, and we worked very well together. And finally, Jehovah vindicated his people and his name in a very big way in Canada. And this book here, entitled Jehovah's Witnesses in Canada, Champions of Freedom of Speech and Worship by M. James Penton. And there's the book, and it's a large book. It's several hundred pages long, 386 pages, and it's got reference to a lot of our cases, you see, in Canada and elsewhere. And it goes in about the battle in Quebec and the Second World War, and about our abstaining from blood. You know, we had blood cases up there in Canada, too. And then it tells about the victory in the courts in Canada and all that, which involved the draft alternative service. Was a draft case, and actually in one of the cases, Brother Leo Greenlees, who's on the governing body, I represented him in the courts up there in Toronto.
That must have been back in, was that in the
40s? Oh, that was in the 40s, yeah.
Because Leo,
Leo Greenlees, 1940. Yeah. Yeah, that was in one of these cases.
Now, let me ask you.
Percy Chapman, it says here, Percy Chapman and Hayden C. Covington, the American Legal Counsel for the two societies, visited Minister of Justice Saint Laurent to request that the ban on those organizations be lifted, you see. That's Percy and I went to see Saint Laurent, who was the Minister of Justice in charge of Canada. Mm-hmm. And that's what it points out right there. That's on page 161. And Mackenzie King was the Prime Minister, of course. And the Prime Minister caused the bans to be removed after that, you see. But it was a hot time in Canada in those
days.
Yeah,
a lot of persecution.
Oh, man, don't you kid yourself. And especially in that Quebec. That Quebec is a bad place. But now, and it's a green place of prosperity for the Lord's people, too.
Yeah, things have really changed, haven't they? Of course, had to break down that wall.
Yeah.
You see?
Mm-hmm.
You know, when you went to court like that, for example, the in the flag salute case, and you'd go up to the Supreme Court, it must have involved quite a tremendous sum of money.
Well, yeah, but the Lord owns all the cattle on Seven Hills.
You can afford it. Huh?
So when you win a case, though, do you still
have
to pay?
Well, sometimes you get it back and sometimes you don't. When Uncle Sam or the state is involved, you don't get anything back. You know?
Yeah.
But in Canada, we got it back.
You got it all back?
Oh, man, we took it off of their hide. But in the United States, you can't get anything off of Uncle Sam.
Yeah.
Oh, boy. You got a chance to go in to see old Harry Truman one time.
Oh, yeah, sure, old Harry Truman. He was a great guy. He was a hot potato. We went in to see Harry, and the way we got in to see Harry was because we were trying to get our pardon petition for Jehovah's Witnesses who had been convicted under the draft considered and allowed by him as the President of the United States. And so it's not easy to get in to see the President, but Harry is approachable, you know. So I knew his next door neighbor, Jim Blair, who was governor of Missouri and who was with me in the first draft case out there in Jefferson City. So when we got down to that, I got in touch with Jim Blair, and he came in
to Washington and set up an appointment in the White House. And Jim and I, and we, Brother Norr wanted to get Brother Kennedy to come along because he was in the Army with old Larry. But that didn't make any impression on Harry because, the thing is, we went in and saw Harry Truman, you see, in the White House, in the Oval Room, you see, and I'm going to tell it exactly what it is if you want to censor it.
Go ahead and tell
it. Yeah, well, we went in to see his honor, his nibs, and Jim Blair was there in the Oval Room, and he found out what it was about. Old Harry did. He slammed his fist down on the desk and nearly broke the presidential desk. He said, I want to tell you that they don't have a goddamn bit of use SOB that won't fight for his country in time of war. And then Jim Blair threw his hands up, oh, Mr. President, Mr. President. And Harry, after we presented the matter to him, and Harry come down off of his high horse and off of his fury, out of his fury, he said, well, I'll refer it to my attorney general. That was Tom Clark, who I knew and who was from Texas, incidentally.
Old Tom.
And he was later on appointed to the Supreme Court of the United States himself by Harry Truman, see? Mm-hmm. And after he was appointed, Tom Clark gave us some favorable decisions in some of our cases, yeah. Mm-hmm. Not because we had influence, but because we were right.
He was, he had some character about him then.
Oh, yes, yeah, he did. Actually, his son, the Attorney General, was quite a liberal man, you know. And, you know, his son is well known for his liberality.
What a
surprised everybody too, and embarrassed, embarrassed of Clark. But still, Clark is—he turned out to be a very fine judge. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And it's amazing. Some of those men had real, like Murphy and like Stone.
Oh boy, that Murphy. Yeah. He was the greatest.
Yeah, they did have character, you know. They had character about them. They stood up for what they felt was right.
Yeah, and actually, old Frank Murphy, I'm telling you, if you read that dissenting opinion that he wrote in that child custody case, the Prince case, Prince against Massachusetts, that is an eloquent thing, and he squared off with all the rest of them and recited about how horrible the Jehovah's Witnesses had been persecuted, you see.
Yeah.
Righteously disposed man, really.
Yeah. Maybe you'll get a reward.
In the resurrection.
Yeah, get a reward in the resurrection, Jehovah willing. You know, it's interesting, though, with all these politicians.
Well, we don't want to forecast anything.
Yeah. A couple of more things that I'd like to know about. Now, for example, you only had a chance to work with Brother Rutherford about 3 years rather closely.
Yeah, that's right.
Because he died in 40?
Yeah, he died in 1942.
Yeah.
But I was there in 39, and we were very, very close. We had to be because of the things we were working together on. And I went out to work with him on the flag brief, you see, the brief in the flag case, the Gabaitis case, in San Diego. That's where we put the Gabaitis brief together, was in San Diego.
When you read the book that he wrote...
Oh, he was eloquent.
Yeah, that's right. He had a tremendous way with words, you know. And was he that way in real life? Did he speak the way he wrote?
Yes, he did. And he was very much a man of... with a great sense of humor, you know. And a man with... he was great to fly off of the handle, too. But the which is human, you know. But I loved him with all my heart. And I never feared him at all. You know,
I guess some people did fear him, though, yeah. Because it was the authority, as it was.
as it were. Yeah, but,
well, that may be true, but still, he was a great man. If he did anything wrong, he'd make up for it.
Yeah.
Again. So you know how he came in the truth, Brother Rutherford?
Well, that's a very unusual thing, and I think it's good that you ask about it. Now, he was had been younger life a book agent selling books, you see, and he was along going along in Missouri and slipped and fell through the ice, and he took pneumonia and was about to die. And he prayed to the Lord that he came out of that, why he would never turn a book agent away, you see. So he was in his office, and he heard his secretary chasing a book agent out of the office, and he ran out of the door and busted out, and he bawled a woman out for running the book agent off. Uh-huh. And it turned out to be one of Jehovah's Witnesses, you see, that was with Pastor Russell's books.
Was it a sister? Seems like we heard it was a sister with a couple of books.
Yeah.
And
then, of course, after that, he got so deeply involved with what he read, just like I did when I was listening to the judge. He was reading Pastor Russell, and he just went over head over heels and bag and baggage for what Brother Russell was doing, and he went for it, you know, unlimitedly and without any constraint and so, or restraint, and so. Then Brother Russell got in litigation, you know, on account of his wife, you know, that sued for the divorce and all that sort of stuff, you know, about the miracle wheat and everything else. And Brother Russell had to have somebody to represent him, and he called on Brother Rutherford to come and represent him in these matters. And Brother Rutherford did, and as a result of that, why, Brother Rutherford asked him to get admitted to the bar, and I've got something around here someplace. If I can dig it up, I can refresh my memory and put on the record the exact dates when he was admitted. I'll have to, if you'll allow me, practice. And New York and in the Supreme Court of the United States on May the 2nd, 1919. Uh-huh. And to the Supreme Court the same year, he was admitted to the bar in New York.
So if there had ever been anything to those, to that trial and that imprisonment, then he never would have been admitted to the bar.
Well, of course, you see, his convictions was reversed, you see. And when that reverse came, that just wiped the slate clean.
Right.
You see. And actually, the convictions were malicious prosecutions anyhow, you know.
Yeah, that's really what they were.
Yeah.
That's correct.
And now let me see if that's anything else I've got there.
In his latter years, did he live?
May 24, 1909, to the United States Supreme Court. 1909.
Is it 9 or 19?
1919. No, 1919. Yeah, 19. That's the day that he was admitted to the Supreme Court. In the same year, he was also admitted to the bar in the state of New York. And then he then became counsel for Pastor Russell after that, you see. And
Pastor Russell died in 19...
Well, Pastor Russell died on the train
Texas,
in Texas while they were on the... And then, of course, organization after that.
Yeah.
Which is a matter of history. I don't have too much clarity on that. You know as much about it as I do by getting the records out and reading them. That's
yeah, I've read. It was good. He was a lawyer, though.
Oh, yeah,
was,
boy, don't kid yourself. Yeah, right.
This thing about him, when he lived out here some in San Diego.
Oh, yeah, now about in San Diego, Brother Rutherford had to get away from the cold, the intense cold in the east in the wintertime. Mm-hmm. And he had one lung, collapsed lung. One lung was collapsed.
Right.
There was danger of him getting pneumonia because of that experience when he fell in the, the water nearly froze to death. You remember? And he said he wouldn't
write.
He wouldn't run a book agent. His office, you see.
And also the prison experience.
Oh, yeah, his prison experience. But here, you see, Brother Rutherford was in there behind bars, and he put his hands up on the bar, and he said to Jehovah, if you ever get me out of here, I want to say that I'm going to give the old whore the worst licking that she ever had, and he would dedicate his whole life, remaining life, to that pursuit, and he did.
He sure did. So he let her have it.
So he came out here to San Diego, and he actually was he out here when he died?
He was. He died in San Diego because he had been operated because of cancer of the colon, you see.
Mm.
And in Indiana, and he was, cancer is a consuming thing, and it gradually began to eat his body down to where there was very little weight on him.
Mm-hmm.
And he called Brother Knorr and Brother Franz and I out to San Diego, and we went out on the Santa Fe train, super chief, not the super chief, the chief, and we went there and we met with him, and he knew he was dying. He wasn't any modeling thing. He just knew that he had his back up to the wall, and he wasn't going to live too long. So he put his hands on the heads of all of us boys. And ask us to stick together.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when I made that declaration that Fred quoted at the assembly in Cincinnati, that to the judge, I said, well, we all called him Pap, for short, meaning Pappy. He was really our father, not real father, but because of age, we considered him to be, giving us orders, and I liked it myself,
Mm-hmm.
So, I said to him, I said, well, Pap, we'll fight him until hell freezes over.
Skate on the ice.
He liked that. And we were at the assembly in Cincinnati. Well, then Fred Franz told the brothers about that quote, which I meant to. It's just like we do. We skate on the ice.
Yeah, sure.
That's
do.
Right.
The Lord will make it so.
What happened to the? Did he want to be buried out at San Diego?
Well, he had no desire to be buried any place, but he. the thing was, he knew he was dying and it had to be buried, and he was sensible enough to know that he didn't want to have his bones hauled all the way back to Brooklyn.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So he suggested that when the time comes for us to bury him, he wanted to be buried out there.
And we tried to get him buried on the Bessarin property, and there was a, you know, a big property in behind there. It went all the way down to Montezuma Road, and then Brother Heath had that big house over across the way that he, his mother had given him money to build, you know, a great big house. Very, I think it cost about $500,000 to build and duplicate now, or more. So we then tried to get him buried there at that property, and they turned us down. They, you know, the board there in San Diego, they wouldn't lie. They didn't want it him buried anywhere out there. You know, it was so much hostility and hatred against the judge. And the authorities just turned us down all every time, every turn we took. And I filed a lawsuit then in the courts out there in San Diego, down in San Diego, for a man that they call a writ of mandate to force him to let us bury him out there on that property someplace. And Judge Mundo, who was the judge of the Superior Court that heard it, why, then he passed the buck, you know, and jumped from one thing to the other and one technicality. And finally, after looking at the matter in a reasonable way, we all, that is Bill and Bonnie and Nathan and all of us, decided, well, we have fought enough on this, and it looks like it's the Lord's will that we take his body back to Brooklyn and have him buried in Staten Island, which we did, not back to Brooklyn, but back to, well, you know how they... Mm-hmm. So Bill and Bonnie went on the train with his body, and Fred and Nathan and I had already come back and were working, you know, away. I was trying to get his bones under the ground by legal mandate, and we couldn't get it, so there was just no other thing to do except to take it, and we did. And that ended that. He was laughing down from heaven while we were
trying to get
scurrying around, to get his bones buried.
He was probably pleased when he finally decided to let it go.
Yeah. Let her go.
So didn't I ever teach them boys anything, you know?
Yeah.
He probably couldn't see how that was connected with the kingdom. Of course, you love the man, see.
Oh, my, yeah.
See, and that's why it was important to you.
Well, we wanted to do his will as best we could, not his will, but Jehovah's will, and it didn't seem he had to be buried someplace.
Yeah.
It wasn't reasonable to haul his body all the way across the country. And we finally had to do that, though. That was the bad part about it, you see.
How long did it take by train to go from...
Well, it took about 3 days, yeah.
Three days.
2.5 days from San Diego. And I made that trip a lot of times, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, from New York to San Diego, sure. Mm-hmm. It takes 2.5 days.
Day and night,
on the Pullman, of course. We rode Pullman. We went first class. Brother Rutherford told me, he said, I don't want you, whenever you travel, I want you to travel first class. So I did. And Brother Heath did, and Nathan did too. All of us did, Freddie and a whole bunch of us.
Yeah, because you needed your rest. And
well, not only
to be
that,
as comfortable
as you could. Yeah, sure. It's not our comfort, but we were entitled to, you know, the labor is worthy of his hire.
You know, really, through those years and those law cases, kind of, you can really see Jehovah's hand in it and how Jehovah built up a, as you would say, a wall around his people. And the wall is still there as long as we don't abuse it. You know, the law really protects us.
Yeah, right. As long as we don't put our foot in the door.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, well, using that as a figure of speech. Abuse it is it, and I don't think that most of us do or will. But, and I'm sure that Jehovah is with us all the way. There's no question about it. This is Jehovah's organization.
Yeah, for sure.
And like Peter says, where we got to go, Lord, there's no...
Where else, yeah.
Brother Covenant, it's good you've really been engaged in a warfare, you know, and it really
You know, of course, Paul talks about the spiritual warfare. You see, the spiritual warfare has been on and all the time. Why? Sometimes it has always has ever been difficult to remember that really we weren't fighting against men and their statutes so much as we were fighting against unseen spirits behind the men. You see?
Yeah, right. Yeah, that's always been my conviction.
Yeah,
it's like Paul says here in the scripture. Where is the one that says, I'm convinced that nothing will separate us from the love?
Romans, I think it's at the end of the 7th chapter, 8th chapter, Romans.
Yeah. I've got kind of a mark.
Another first Bible.
Yeah.
I may never get another chance. So I think it's in Romans.
Ephesians 6:10, he talks about, 6, he talks about the fight against the wicked spirit forces.
Chapter 8, the end of chapter 8.
Yeah, right. Yeah, here it is right here. I've got it underscored.
Yeah. For I am convinced that neither death, nor life, nor angels, nor governments, nor things nor now here, nor things to come, nor powers, nor height, nor depth, nor any other creation will be able to separate us from God's love that is in Christ Jesus our Lord. So if you hadn't had Jehovah's backing, you would not have been able to outmaneuver demonic forces.
Oh, no, no.
Yeah. So they could have.
And we know, too, that it's like we wrestle not with flesh and blood. Mm-hmm. You see, that's what he said, but against the demons, you see.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what you got to keep in mind all the time. If you don't, well, then you can't, you're sure to lose, you see. And you've got to recognize the power that's against us, with less Jehovah's helping us out, we're just dead ducks.
It helps us to keep from hating people so much, too, because we realize they're not being used.
Yeah, well, they're just pawns in the hands of the devil. And so.
Yeah. Even someone who really disliked the witnesses very much, like old Felix Frankfurter, you know, he was just a...
He was a pawn in the hand of the devil, and so. And after all, Jehovah doesn't hold it against people. You know, I mean, the main thing is that we keep on keeping on and never throw the sponge in. That's my philosophy about it. Because if you've got any impromptu questions that you would like to use on me, why, feel...
I think that's about out of hand.
I'm not trying to run for any office or anything.
No.
But it really is encouraging to me just to, you know, listen to your experiences and hear you talk. It really is it's inspiring. I appreciate it very much.
Thank you.